DFRU 93.3 FM, la radio comunitaria de la Universidad de Guelph en Ontario, Canadá, y por internet para el mundo en www.cfru.ca, así como nuestros blogs Mujeres por la Democracia blogspot.com y Alternativa Latinoamericana blogspot.com. Se despiden de ustedes desde Colombia nuestro compañero y amigo periodista y activista Luis Alberto Castaño, con su equipo de colaboradores periodistas del colectivo de comunicación Radicales Libres, Silvia Oviedo, Marta Botero y Andrés Barbosa. Desde Sydney, Australia, la querida Daniela Villegas, periodista feminista y maestra en estudios de género. Desde mi adolorido México, en la península de Yucatán, la querida periodista feminista, colaboradora de Caos en la Red, Lorena Aguilar. Y desde esta cabina de radio, la queridísima Madeleine Speed, mi compañero Sergio Pochón y quien les habla, su amiga Hilda Venegas, nos despedimos deseándoles una noche con el deseo de justicia social para nuestros pueblos, que si el presente es de lucha, el futuro es nuestro. Buenas noches y hasta la próxima.
You're listening to Back in the USSR.
I flex up my bowling for T-Rex, and I learn my hard lessons a jar of checks. I get vexed on an MC rejects, the resonance of my rap which is complex. I got a rep for words which are head wrecks, cause they can't understand the context of my index. I slip into a mode which is big steps, have to rock a rhyme which is in depth. Water city streets which are windswept, protect with a knife where the lines get lives kept. Busting loose with my rhyme cause I can't be kept. Back from the fall where I'll dissect and intercept the propaganda that we elect. Clarify the claim of my dialect. You say you're a liberal, I say what the heck, redistribution. You say where's my check, but check yourself. Guy, guess this, what you get, reap what you sow. Then I bet your friend, not to get you down is one thing I wouldn't let, but to make it wise, so you can reject the system, not a complex. It just infects the minds of the young, like a simplex, simplex.
My word is read into rap cause I'm a pioneer. We got the words to be heard, so listen up here. Always lead from the front, never from the rear. Don't talk revolution from my armchair. All I stand up for also give a big cheer for the crew which I'm in, who my life fears. Thank you.
You're listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU. I am Siegfried. And I do actually have an announcement that I need to make concerning the very near future of this show. I've chosen once again, this will be the second time I'm doing it, to go to China to teach English. And unfortunately this time, we unfortunately have no Patrick O'Brien around to take over the show while I'm away. So this time, unfortunately, I'm going to have to put the show on hiatus come September, which is something I'm not really looking forward to doing. This show has been such a huge part of my life over the last, 6 years. It's been a very long, period of time, when I've been doing this show, and it's been a very integral part of my life. But certainly I'm going to try to make the next few shows that I have here really count. It's definitely an anomaly to admit that one is a communist in Canada. And it's even harder once you admit it to explain to people what communism is all about. That's actually something I've been working on throughout the 6 years or so that I've been doing this show. And it's not an easy thing. It requires a lot of trial and error. Explaining communism to contemporary Canadians is challenging because people just don't have a framework for understanding it. Or if they do, it's almost always based on anti-communist Cold War propaganda. Think about it. You don't get exposed to communism in school, and if you are, it's almost always going to be through the lens of your high school English teacher reading Animal Farm as if it were actual history. Or your high school history teacher telling you with a false certainty that he doesn't even bother backing up with facts that Stalin murdered this many millions of people. It's rare to get anything more nuanced than that. In my case, I was lucky enough to have a Marxist history teacher in high school who was absolutely brilliant in teaching us about the real face of European colonization of the Americas and of European imperialism around the world. But he never really said anything about actual socialist countries and what they were really like. Whether that's Cuba, China, Soviet Union, or anything. I was actually pretty radical and pro-communist by the time I left high school. But my understanding of it was weak. So when I came to university and came up against a whole lot of anti-communist positions from professors, I ended up assuming that they knew better and largely abandoned my own radicalism as a result. It wasn't until years later, after I'd done a master's degree in political science, saw for myself the poisonous culture that exists within academia, discovered Michael Parenti's work, and followed international events like the Iraq War and other U.S. military interventions, and saw the destruction they caused, that I finally embraced communism with a real understanding of it. For me, it was a long road. A road of self-discovery, with many twists and turns, and it's difficult to imagine that it could have been otherwise. What Marxism has really given me, and what it gives to everyone who adopts it, is a framework for understanding the world, the means of understanding the world in a real concrete way, for understanding how politics works, how economics work, even how many cultural and religious forces work, and the things they do around the world. Historical materialism, which is the basis of Marxism, of Marxist theory, is about understanding the world in terms of the development of productive forces, of economic forces, and class power. It explains why wealth has traditionally been concentrated in the hands of a tiny minority, why armed force has been used again and again to serve the interests of that tiny minority, and why the vast majority of humanity labors in poverty without meaningful control over their own lives and without benefiting from the fruits of their own labor. It explains war, imperialism, colonization, slavery, racism, and just about all the other major questions and issues of our time in a way that no other theory or outlook can hope to match. Virtually all of these problems persist because they serve the material interests, the profit motive of the ruling class the capitalist class in some way. Obama could have moved against racism during his presidency in a very serious way, but he didn't. He did not do so, because to do so would mean undermining the interests of the American capitalist class, that for more than three centuries has been able to maintain its dominance largely by keeping working class people stratified according to race, and therefore largely unable to work together effectively against their bosses for real change. Obama, like all American presidents, is the guardian of the capitalist system. And as such, his anti-racism mostly took the form of appointing a select few black people to top government positions in the service of the Fortune 500. Something that requires the perpetuation of racism against the vast majority of working class African Americans who are still portrayed as thugs, criminals, and similar negative stereotypes in the mainstream media and by the police and state authorities. The same goes for Justin Trudeau's new strategy for a, quote, nation-to-nation relationship with indigenous people in this country, which also entails appointing a select few indigenous people to top positions and co-opting them to advance the interests of the Canadian capitalist class in building mines, oil pipelines, etc. on traditional indigenous land. And remember, the Canadian capitalist class has always viewed the indigenous people as an obstacle. The expansion of their profits, which, you know, rely on mining and oil extraction and gas extraction, all this sort of thing. And the same goes for why America and Canada are targeting countries like Libya and Syria for destruction. Countries that have traditionally exercised independent control over their economic affairs and thereby stood in the way of the profits of multinational oil cartels and the like. Similar to the indigenous peoples and nations who stood in the way of capitalist expansion in North America and were thus targeted for destruction by the governments of Canada and the United States in the 19th century. And the same goes for austerity and why so many human services are being cut back right now by governments that don't want the public sector to get in the way of private profits. Marxism allows us to understand all these things. But beyond that, it also gives us the tools to confront these things and through struggle change these things. Please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.
So greedy, 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 greedy. So greedy, 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 greedy. Now they say they kept a tiger in my hometown, brings jewels and crowns, picks you up off the ground. But the Celtic tiger does two things. It brings you good luck, or it eats you up for a supper. It's the tale of two cities on the Shamrock Shore. Please, sir, can I have some more? If you hear the tiger roar, run for the door, cause if you are poor, you'll be eaten for sure. And that's how we know the poor have more taste than the rich. And that's how we know the poor have better taste than the rich. Hear the Celtic tiger roar it one more. Celtic tiger roar it one more. The fastest growing inflation rate in the world. The cost of a rundown house is absurd. This is the dandy age for a low income wage. Ask anyone who's locked in a cage. A couple with kids can't afford a place to live. Even if they
simply have a good job or being robbed by the builders and the fat cat government, the League of Greed, and they don't even need for a thing. It's a sin, but it's the nature of the beast. You better go and find a priest and confess, because your greed is gonna leave you soulless.
Can't you see?
Feed the Celtic tiger, roar it one more.
And you shall not have a lead.
Feed the Celtic tiger, roar it one more. Gonna live, what we gonna do? We'll have to move in with the woman in the shoe. They're driving us onto the streets, while the fat cat in government cheats and always gets away with his crime. A kid steals a jacket and does time. Just look at the world around you. Tell me, why is there so much need? Because of greed. Because of greed. So greedy, 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 greedy. So greedy. Tiger, roar it one more.
And you shall not have a name.
Hear the Celtic tiger, roar it one more.
Other God but me.
Hear the Celtic tiger, roar it one more.
I am your God, you see.
Hear the Celtic tiger, roar it one more.
You could look at any existing socialist country, if you don't want to call them socialists, call them whatever you want, post-capitalist, whatever, I don't care, call them camels, window shades, doesn't matter, as long as we know the countries we're talking about. You can look at any one of those countries, and you can evaluate them in several ways. One, comparing them to what they had before. And that, to me, is what's very compelling. That's what's so compelling about Cuba, for instance. When I was in Cuba, I was up in the Escambray, which is like the Appalachia of Cuba, very rugged mountains, the poor people, very poor, they were. And I said to this campesino, I said, do you like Fidel? And he says, si, with all our souls. I remember his gesture, with all our souls. I said, why? And he pointed to this clinic right up there on the hill, which we had visited. He said, look at that. He said, before the revolution, we never saw a doctor. If someone was seriously ill, it would take 20 people to carry that person. Because you'd go day and night. It would take 2 days to get to the hospital. First, because it was far away, and second, because you couldn't go straight. You couldn't cross the latifundio lands. The boss would kill you. So you had to go like this. And often when we got to the hospital, the person might be dead by the time we got there. Now we have this clinic up here with a full-time doctor. And today, a doctor in Cuba, when you become a doctor, you've got to spend 2 years out in the country. That's your dedication to the people. And a dentist who comes 1 day a week. And for more serious things, we're not more than 20 minutes away from a larger hospital. That's in the Escambray. He said, that's freedom. We're freer today. We have more life. And I talked to a guy in Havana who says to me, Before, all I used to see here in Havana, you call this drab and dull. We see it as a cleaner city. It's true, you got up, the paint is peeling off the walls, but you don't see kids begging in the streets anymore, and you don't see prostitutes. Always that was prostitutes. Prostitution used to be one of the biggest industries. And today, this man is going to night school. He said, I can read. I can read. Do you know what it means to be able to read? Do you know what it means to be able not to read? I remember when I gave my book to my father, I dedicated a book of mine, Power and the Powerless, to my father. I said, to my father with my love. Gave him a copy of the book. He opened it up, looked at that. He'd only gone to the seventh grade. He was a son of an immigrant, a working class Italian. And he opens the book and he starts looking through it and he gets misty-eyed, very misty-eyed. And I thought it was because he was so touched that his son had dedicated a book to him. That wasn't the reason. He looks up to me and says, I can't read this, kid. I said, that's okay, Dad. Neither can the students. I mean, that's not something. I mean, don't worry about that. I wrote it for you. I mean, it's your book, and you don't have to read it. You know, it's a very complicated book, academic book. He says, yeah, I can't read this book. And the defeat that man felt. That's what illiteracy is about. That's what the joy of literacy programs is. That's why in Nicaragua you got people walking proud now for the first time. They were animals before. They weren't allowed to read. They weren't taught to read. So you compare a country to what it came from with all its imperfections. And those who demand instant perfection, the day after the revolution, they get up and say, are there civil liberties for the fascists? Are they going to be allowed to have their newspapers and their radio program? Are they going to be able to keep all their farms? The passion that some of our liberals feel the day after the revolution, the passion and concern they feel for the fascists, the civil rights and civil liberties of those fascists who were dumping and destroying and murdering people before. Now the revolution has got to be perfect. It's got to be flawless. Well, that isn't my criteria. My criteria is what happens to those people who couldn't read. What happens to those babies that couldn't eat, that died of hunger? And there, that's why I support revolution. The revolution that feeds the children gets my support. Not blindly, not unqualifiedly. And the Reaganite government that tries to stop that kind of process, that tries to keep those people in poverty and illiteracy and hunger, that gets my undiluted animosity and opposition.
Listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU, that was Michael Parenti talking about the Cuban Revolution in a speech he did in Denver, Colorado in 1986. Like I said before, he's had an amazing impact on me in terms of me developing as a Marxist. But you're listening to Back in the USSR. The song before Michael Parenti's clip there was Damien Dempsey, Celtic Tiger. And I should also say at the beginning of the show, the first song I played at the beginning was Theme from Marxman by Marxman. British Marxist band from the rap group, I should say. Hip-hop group from the early 90s. But I want to continue here with a quote from Chapter 6 of Proletarian God, Building the Socialist Future. This is my book. And thus my quote. The big monsters that dominate the capitalist system and unleash the carnage of imperialism on the world can only survive through the creation and multiplication of little monsters who will serve their interests or do their bidding out of fear, loyalty, tradition, patriotism, religious fervor, greed, cynicism, or any number of other reasons. What all of these reasons have in common is that they stem from the reactionary propaganda machine that dominates the world's airwaves and fulfills this essential function of class control. End quote. In most parts of the world, communism is essentially taboo. Either it's not talked about at all or presented as a menace to all that is good and holy. I've already discussed how Marxism gives us a scientific framework with which to analyze and understand the world. But communism gives us something more than that. It gives us a moral creed and a way of life that allows us to understand concepts of good and evil, right and wrong. Whether something is right or wrong to a communist depends largely on the class interest that it serves and the material impact that it has on the world and on human beings. I'll use the example of nationalism and national identity to illustrate what I mean. Nationalism can be revolutionary or reactionary, progressive or non-progressive, depending on whose interests it serves and its character, which can inevitably change over time. Its class character, I should say. The militant nationalism that emerged in Europe, for example, in the wake of the French Revolution, and that gave rise to national movements and revolutionary uprisings across the continent in the 1830s and 1840s, was progressive because it challenged the very underpinnings of European feudalism and feudal class society, and facilitated the rise of bourgeois and proletarian class struggles. This same nationalism would take on a very reactionary character by the early 20th century when it facilitated the First World War, propelling capitalist interests of profit and imperial expansion at the expense of working class people who died in their millions on the battlefield. 20th century African nationalism emerged in the context of anti-colonial resistance and presented a challenge to the dominant capitalist interests in the world as represented by the colonial powers of Europe and America. However, today, such nationalisms often reinforce the control of local capitalist elites, who are themselves little more than puppets of the IMF, World Bank, and the U.S. State Department. American nationalism, that emerged in the context of slavery and colonial empire building, is just as reactionary as the nationalism of apartheid South Africa, and cannot be compared to the nationalism of countries like Cuba and China, which are grounded in socialist revolution and the struggle for national self-determination against empire. Concrete historical conditions determine what is good and bad for a communist, and this is why we support the efforts of certain countries and oppose that of others. Even if some of the nations we support are not truly socialist, if they stand against imperialism, they stand against the IMF and the World Bank and, you know, the Pentagon and the CIA and all these forces, they are acting in a historically progressive way. And a good example of that is, of course, the example of Syria, which is not a socialist country, but nonetheless is standing up against imperialism and resisting heroically against imperialism. This is actually a clip from Bashar Jaafari, who is the ambassador of Syria to the United Nations. This is what he said in the wake of the last elections in Syria, which were not recognized by the United States and the other imperialist countries of the world, largely because they demonstrated the overwhelming support the Syrian people have to their government, which is fighting, of course, against the imperialist forces which are devastating the country. Let's have a listen to that.
Well, Syria's ambassador to the United Nations, Bashar Jaafari, says the recent developments in the Middle East, particularly the unrest in Syria, are part of a geopolitical plan designed by the West. In an exclusive interview with Press TV, the Syrian official also said by taking part in Syria's presidential election, the Syrians said no to foreign interference in their country's internal affairs.
Condoleezza Rice called it the creative chaos 10 years ago as a justification of the American-British invasion of Iraq. So this plan did not end, as you know. It's continuous. They broke down Libya, they broke down Egypt, they broke down Iraq, Yemen. Now it's Syria's turn. So this is a geopolitical plan that is not only targeting Syria exclusively, although Syria is very important for either the success or the failure of this plan. But it is targeting the whole area. And ultimately speaking, the main goal is to secure for a long time, at a very long range, the interests of Israel and preventing the establishment of the Palestinian state in Palestine. So they need to open up a new front of a kind of deviation from the focus on the Arab-Israeli conflict and the Palestinian question to another focus, which might be a war between Muslims and Muslims. They call it Sunni and Shiite, but it's not a war between Sunni and Shiite. It's a war against Iran in Iraq, against Iran in Syria, against Iran in Lebanon, against Iran in Yemen, against Iran in Egypt. The success of the elections gave and the popular mobilization, unprecedented popular mobilization in favor of the election, organizing the elections and in favor of electing President Assad, is a kind of message sent by the Syrian people to all over the world that, guys, do not interfere in our domestic affairs. Our message would be a friendly message to all the people, actually. We want to have friends, not enemies. We are not seeking any animosity with anybody. We want to have friends and we want to have normal bilateral relationship with everybody. We do not interfere into the American domestic affairs. Please do not interfere into our own domestic affairs.
Come on, you poor workers, good news to you, I'll tell how the good old Union has come in here to dwell. Which side are you on? Which side are you on? We're starting our good battle, we know we're sure to win, because we've got the gun, thugs are looking very thin. Which side are you on?
Come all you good workers, good news to you I'll tell, of how the good old Union has come in here to dwell.
Which side are you on, boys? Which side are you on? Which side are you on, boys? Which side are you on? Which side are you on, boy?
You're listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM. That was Natalie Merchant with Which Side Are You On? And of course, we had the Syrian ambassador, the UN, talking about the self-determination of his country in resistance to imperialism in the wake of the last Syrian elections in 2015. Now, so we're talking about nationalism and how nationalism relates to class, and that really determines whether it's progressive or not. Canadian nationalism is an especially interesting example of reactionary nationalism. Canadian nationalism is not progressive. And I'm going to explain why. Here I'll discuss two forms of Canadian national identity, both of which are examples of colonialism. Both of which reinforce capitalist class control, although one is rarely recognized as such. The first and oldest of the two is the traditional Anglophile, intensely pro-British nationalism that is still very much in vogue in the Canadian Armed Forces and among certain segments of the white settler population in this country. This is the nationalism of 1812, Isaac Brock, Vimy Ridge, Juno Beach, and so on. As a form of national identity, it is problematic in many ways because it is not grounded in the idea of Canadian national self-determination, but in subservience to the British Empire and the idea of Canada as a loyal colonial outpost defending the interests of the mother country. You know, it has parallels with certain strands in Australian nationalism. Given its open support for empire, colonialism, foreign wars, and so on, the reactionary character of this nationalism is clear to most progressive people in this country, I would say, though there certainly are exceptions to that. The second example is rarely viewed in the same light, but I would argue it's essentially almost equally reactionary in a different way. What might be called modern Canadian nationalism was largely the product of the Liberal Party, that's right, the Liberal Party, and its leaders during the 1960s and 1970s. I mean, I'm talking particularly about Lester Pearson and Pierre Trudeau, who were its main architects of this modern Canadian nationalism, which of course came in as Canada in the 60s and 70s as Canada was moving away from its identification as a British colony in a new post-war era of international relations. During this period, the mythology surrounding peacekeeping, Canada as a middle power and an honest broker, and perhaps most importantly, as a multicultural society, came into vogue, as did the modern Canadian flag, Canada Day celebrations, which hadn't happened at all, like really in the past, certainly not in official capacity, and most of the things that Canadians now associate with Canadian national identity. It's very, very recent stuff. Most Canadians consider this nationalism as benign, as non-threatening, and many progressives identify strongly with it. One of the main points of attack used against Stephen Harper in the last federal election, and of course I was running in the federal election, so I heard a lot of this, not only by the Liberals, but by the NDP and the Greens, was that Harper and the Conservatives had deviated from these Canadian national ideals in various ways. And they were somehow introducing foreign concepts into Canada. Of course, the idea that Canada, a steadfast member of the NATO alliance, is an honest broker, the idea that Canada is an honest broker and a benign peacekeeping nation that just wants to help is extremely problematic. I would recommend reading Eve Engler's book, The Black Book of Canadian Foreign Policy, for details on this. You know, how Canadian peacekeepers helped facilitate the downfall and assassination of Patrice Lumumba, the first democratically elected president of the Congo, while they were engaged in a supposedly benign peacekeeping mission. How Canadian peacekeepers played a key role in the destruction and dismemberment of Yugoslavia under the guise of humanitarian intervention. how Canadian peacekeepers committed terrible abuses against people in Somalia, and another humanitarian intervention. And then, of course, there's Afghanistan, Libya, and now Syria, where Canada has worked hand in glove with the United States in supporting militant groups, in supporting the militant groups terrorizing the country. But I want to focus on the issue of multiculturalism, most of all, because it really is a major plank of Canadian national identity today, and I don't think a lot of people understand how it came about and why, because it can hardly be described as a benevolent policy when it comes right down to it. The early 1970s was a period of major upheavals in Canadian society, particularly surrounding the struggles of French Canadians, who had really been second-class citizens in this country for its first 100 years of existence. And yes, the whole idea that Confederation somehow represented an agreement on equal terms between French and English Canadians is nonsense. Quebec in particular was defying the federal government. Quebecois workers were going on strike in massive numbers, expressing solidarity with the Black Panthers and national liberation struggles around the world, occupying entire towns and kicking out the authorities for months at a time, and so on. And then on top of that, you have the development of the FLQ and the October Crisis and all that stuff. If you want to understand the roots of the massive student strike that gripped Quebec a few years ago, look no further. You know, it comes from that period, where you really had a mass mobilization of French Canadians really pushing for the assertion of their national rights. You know, after a full century of being marginalized, essentially, and not really having control over their own affairs. Indigenous peoples were also increasingly organizing at this time and mobilizing and resisting colonial impositions like the residential school regime that was still going strong in the 60s and 70s, and would indeed continue to do so right up until the 90s. The colonial character of Canadian society was increasingly being challenged at this time from multiple fronts, and there was a growing radicalism from traditionally oppressed nationalities within Canada. It was posing real challenge to the government and to the capitalist state in this country. And of course, the notorious declaration of martial law during the October Crisis was one response that the Trudeau government gave to this situation. And multiculturalism was another. Canadian communists in the 1970s analyzed multiculturalism fundamentally as a divide and conquer strategy, and I think this was fundamentally correct way of looking at it. Because think about it, by making immigrant communities, at least on paper, into distinct nations within Canadian society, what Trudeau and the Canadian capitalist class he represented were doing was really seeking to marginalize the national struggles of Aboriginal Canadians and French Canadians, thus maintaining colonialism through soft power and sleight of hand. You know, almost basically saying, like, okay, see, you know, French Canadians and Indigenous people, they're just one nation among many, many in this tossed salad, or the many other, you know, terms that have been used to describe multiculturalism in this country over the years. You know, and somehow, like, you know, these kind of nations, that minimizes their national grievances and their experiences and the oppression they've experienced under colonialism and all that sort of thing. You know, it sidelines all that. And of course, Quebec never signed on to the Canadian Constitution in the 1980s, effectively being shut out of the final proceedings, and the Indigenous peoples were never even consulted in the first place in the development of that Constitution. You know, it's no coincidence the essentially meaningless term multiculturalism, which has done nothing to combat racism or colonialism in Canadian society. You know, you still get police harassment and murder of, you know, Black Canadians and and of immigrants and all sorts of things, you know, and, you know, really in concrete terms, it has not achieved anything for those people. You know, except maybe formed a certain, you know, a client base for the Liberal Party among certain immigrant communities and things like that, which definitely has done. It's no coincidence that multiculturalism came along when it did. You know, in the late 60s and early 70s, when, of course, the capitalist system was under attack in Canadian society. And so, of course, they needed to find an ideological smokescreen to conceal their agenda, to basically make colonialism look warm and fuzzy. And they chose multiculturalism to do that. Not that it was the only thing that they employed to do that, but, you know, that was one of their choice methods right there. And it's still around to this day as a part of Canadian national identity. But of course, now as then, it still is buttressing colonialism. And is effectively being used to marginalize the struggles of indigenous people, in particular in this country now. And that's very important to understand. You know, we don't do enough analysis of really what Canadian nationalism looks like. And really, fundamentally, it isn't a very pretty picture. You know, when you see the fundamental situation of a settler colonial state existing on occupied indigenous land and exploiting that land, you know, for the purpose of capitalist profits, that's not a pretty picture. So it needs to be cloaked in all this kind of language, and multiculturalism is one of the ways that it gets cloaked. And of course, the capitalist class initiates this and then disseminates it throughout society and, you know, and puts it in the school system and all this sort of thing. And so you don't actually get real issues of racism and colonialism and imperialism and things like that being challenged, tackled. Instead, you get this whitewash. And this stuff's very important to understand. Please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.
Well, sisters and brothers, I've decided that there's white trash in this country, but don't look among the rural poor or Appalachia to find them. The real white trash is in the corporate boardrooms, the governor's mansion, the courthouses, the national media. If you work for or ally yourselves with the high place vipers and hypocrites and thieves and polluters and repressors and assassins, you are trash. I am sick of these so-called leaders who are leading us to the slaughter. I'm sick of their blow-dry hairdos, their sleek, beefy, money-fed smiles, their pinstripe suits, and their tight-ass struts down the corridors of power. I'm sick of the sight of them, and I hate them with all the passion of my humanity, and don't anybody tell me to feel otherwise.
Il y a des cela, des lunes alors que la terre de nos terres était encore brune et que les pères de nos pères burinaient les runes. Chacune des contrées se sont rencontrées afin de contrer une lacune remarquée par le monarque des monarques. Yvan, désireux de laisser sa marque de commerce, voulait lever les herses afin que le commerce perce les barrières et que les sesterces s'acquièrent sans frontières. Manifestement, Yvan, l'empereur de la parole, les paumes sales et souillées de sang. Il a bâti son royaume, en assujet de sang. Tout à la fois les petits gnomes, que les clans les plus puissants. Sous son immense rond, blanc et resplendissant. Et depuis ce temps sous le chaume, les paysans sont agonisants.
Yvan, les paumes sales et souillées de sang. Les paysans sous le chaume sont agonisants.
Soit-disant pour remédier à ce merdier, Yvan invite à sa table tous les notables. Un seul est jugé indésirable, un incroyable nain à la barbe vénérable, en exil dans une île,
coupable
de n'avoir jamais fléchi l'échine devant la machine du seigneur de la rancœur de pierre qui tient rigueur à l'insulaire et l'isole dans son atoll. Les monarques unis pour abattre les clôtures se sont réunis entre quatre murs afin que le plus petit de leurs murmures meure sous le cliquetis des armures. L'or est au leur à la bataille des murailles. Au-delà du portail, c'est la ripaille pour les quelques canailles. Mais pas une grenaille ne reste pour la marmaille.
Mais pas une grenaille ne reste pour la marmaille.
Camarades, tous aux barricades, à l'assaut de la palissade. Fini la mascarade, pas question qu'on nous mène à l'abattoir sans pouvoir savoir ce que le pouvoir nous cache dans le noir. Camarades, tous aux barricades, à l'assaut de la palissade. Fini la mascarade, pas question qu'on nous mène à l'abattoir sans pouvoir savoir ce que le pouvoir nous cache dans le noir. Samouraï et racaille aux portes des murailles, avec l'OCO et l'OCASS s'adresse à la herse de la forteresse où se taire les saints des spadassins assassins. Yvan le suffisant, ombre sombre, nombre suffisant pour éradiquer le clan des dissidents. Ils disséminaient les dents aux 80, amène nu sanguin.
Sanguin, ils feront pas semblant.
Mais pour l'instant, seul coule la salive et les invectives. Des deux côtés de la rive, les regards se rivent, la tension est vive. On est sur le qui-vive en attendant que l'inévitable arrive. Et quand de main de maître, on perce le périmètre. La clé crapique, les flics paniquent comme des liens qui passent à l'attaque et matraque du tac au tac, tac au tac, tac tac. C'est le saccage, la bête a sorti de sa cage. On nage en plein Moyen-Âge, casque et masque et l'escadron font sur tous les flancs comme un faucon sur un fan. Mais pas question qu'on capitule. Arti part, tu pars ici la catapulte. Selon les calculs, on peut percer le rempart, le grand rempart. En haut du château, on lance des carreaux. Certains sont chaos sur le carreau, c'est le chaos. Des poules dans les faubourgs jusqu'au petit jour. C'est ainsi que voulant faire vaciller les sorciers du pouvoir qui n'ont pas sourcillé. Le peuple a fini éparpillé, éparpillé comme un lévrier, tout un quartier ouvrier. Et pendant que les tribus s'attribuent le tribut du rififi, le royaume s'unifie et se solidifie sous le dôme fantôme de l'économie. L'économie. Les monarques unis pour abattre les clôtures se sont réunis entre quatre murs afin que le plus petit de leurs murmures meure sous le cliquetis des armures. L'heure est au leur à la bataille des murailles.
Au-delà du portail, c'est la ripaille pour les quelques canailles. Mais pas une grenaille ne reste pour la marmaille.
Mais pas une grenaille ne reste pour la marmaille.
Listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU. That was Loco Locas with La Bataille de Murai. And of course we had Michael Parenti talking about, you know, where you can find the white trash in America. You know? And of course I've been talking about what, I guess you could say, like what right and wrong means for communists. Like communism is a moral creed as much as it is a way of looking at the world and analyzing the world and what goes on. And ultimately, right, and these two things are interconnected, very much so. Ultimately, right and wrong for the communist depends on knowledge. Knowledge of the material realities of the world. Whether we support something or oppose it, whether we love something or hate it, depends on what it does and who it serves. Whereas reactionaries teach downtrodden, frustrated, and exploited people to hate and attack meaningless scapegoats or powerless minority populations. Revolutionaries teach them to join hands against their real oppressors and exploiters. Reactionary hatred is based on irrational fear of the stereotypical other. Deliberately encouraged, by the way, by the very rational interests of a ruling class that does not want to face the united strength of the people it exploits and whose labor it depends on. So it tries to divide and conquer them all the time by pitting them against scapegoats and what have you. Revolutionary hatred, on the other hand, is based on knowledge. Knowledge of who the real enemies of the working class are. Knowledge of the real nature, the real horrific nature of capitalism as a system that treats people as objects and commodities to be used and abused in the name of making a profit. Knowledge of the real atrocities of imperialism and the unspeakable lengths that the capitalist class will go to expand and secure its control over land, labor, and resources around the world. Knowledge that these things are not accidents, but deliberate atrocities designed to serve the interests of the few at the expense of the many. And knowledge that human beings will never be free to even be fully human until this system is overthrown. As communists, this is why we fight. If you want to understand communism, that's very important to understand. Central to who we are. Please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.
This is why.